LeFrançois and her seamstress friend, taking their meager sandwiches out to enjoy the fine weather. But when Eve spread the threadbare blanket, Lily didn't bother with sandwiches. She produced a stick of charcoal and began mapping the surrounding ground in her quick notation on the spread-out petticoat. "It's getting harder to get written papers through," she said, with a touch of her usual twinkle through the fierce concentration. "But those guards have no idea how much information can be written down on a woman's petticoat. Why am I here? Violette knows the region better. Shouldn't she be helping compile the report?" "She already has. But you're the one who first heard about the Kaiser's visit, little Daisy. You deserve to be kept in the loop." Lily's hand darted hummingbird quick, noting the ground, the irregularities, the tracks, the trees.
"When I deliver my report to Uncle Edward, he's asked me to bring you."
Me? "He wants to interview you. See if there's any more detail he can possibly milk out of your recollections. For something this big, they take no chances. We'll leave in 2 days." Seeing Captain Cameron in 2 days. The thought should have been a balm, but it just made Eve feel strange. He seemed so far away, he might as well be in a different world. And the logistics of such a visit made her stomach flip far more than the thought of his warm eyes. I can't possibly travel to Folkestone. I don't dare miss any work.
"We won't have to travel all the way to Folkestone,"
Lily calmly finished her jotted notations.
"Uncle Edward has agreed to meet us across the border, in Brussels. We'll be back within a day.
The way I talk, I'll be noticed too much at the checkpoint. I'll get you caught.
If Lily got arrested because of Eve's stammering tongue, she'd cut it out with a rusty razor.
"Je m'en fous." Lily ruffled her hair. "Let me do the talking. I'm used to wheedling my way in and out of train stations. You just give that look of splendid, wide-eyed innocence. It'll all be right as rain." "How right is rain, anyway? What peculiar expressions you English have."
Lily was lightening the mood deliberately. Eve knew that. All the airy chatter as she stepped back into her charcoal-mapped petticoat was intentional.
"You should take more care," Eve said, collecting the picnic things.
"Don't take it all as such a joke. You'll laugh yourself right into a firing squad."
"Bah!"
Lily gave a wave of her hand, a hand so thin it was nearly transparent in the sunlight.
"I know I'll be caught one day, but who cares? I shall at least have served. So let's hurry and do great things while there is yet time."
"There isn't much time,"
Eve groaned, following Lily down the hill.
2 days and we're off to Brussels. How am I supposed to get away for a day?"
"See if you can make some excuse at Lulette."
A sidelong glance as they trailed down the slope, back in the direction of town.
"How is your beastly suitor?"
Eve didn't want to think about René Bordelon. She'd been trying to keep out of his way since the night he walked her home. At Lulette, she whisked away plates, poured schnapps, and listened. She even managed to compile a report on this German ace pilot, Max Immelmann, while trying to keep out of her employer's sight. But he let her know he was still watching her, waiting for an answer. Sometimes it was a wordless stare at her neck, where she could feel his tongue savoring her skin. Sometimes it was the gulp of wine he offered her from a lip-printed glass at closing time. What a world it was when a few swallows of wine from a stranger's glass could be a courtship gesture to a girl presumed half-starved and desperate.
"He's persistent," Eve said at last.
Lily pushed a strand of hair behind one ear.
"Have you been able to put him off?"
"For now."
And really, in the life she led, was there anything else besides now? Seeing Captain Cameron in 2 days, the Kaiser's arrival in 10. It all existed in the same gray area. There was the past and the now. Nothing else was certain. Nothing else was real. At Lulette that night, the chatter seemed brighter than usual. The bustle of the officers noisier. The laughter of the women on their arms more giddy.
"Whores,"
Christine whispered as she and Eve stood against the wall, waiting to be summoned by a lifted finger.
"That's Françoise Ponceau over there, preening in a new silk dress and pressing herself up against that captain. You know the baker makes special bread for sluts like that. He pisses on the dough before he rolls it out."
They deserve it, Eve agreed, though her stomach churned.
The girl had anxious eyes over her smiles, and she'd been slipping rolls into her pocketbook all night when her captain's back was turned. She was feeding someone at home, more likely several someones, and in return she got piss-soaked bread and epithets. But it was safer to agree with Christine's whispered opinion because, frankly, most of Lille shared it. René looked up then at his waitresses, candlelight catching a glitter from his eyes.
Look at Christine, Eve begged inside. Pretty and blonde and dense as a post. Why won't you look at Christine?
But he crooked his finger at Eve, and she came forward to pour the after-dinner drinks, and René's lips curved in appreciation for her unhurried silence, the exact arc of her arm.
Can someone else take the ledger up?
Eve asked the other waiters at the end of the night, but they just laughed.
It's your duty now, Marguerite. He's always in a better mood if you take it up, and we like Monsieur René in a good mood.
They snickered, and Eve realized that René's eyes on her hadn't gone unnoticed.
You're all pigs, she snarled, and stamped up the back stairs.
A curtsy, and his fingers whispered dryly over her own, as she handed over the nightly account.
Are you in a hurry, Mademoiselle Lefrançois?
Flicking through the neat lines.
No, monsieur.
He took his time, rustling pages. In the heat of the summer night, he'd discarded his jacket and sat in his snow-white shirt sleeves, hair as sleek as his leather shoes with brilliantine. His cufflinks were unexpected spots of color, ruby red and flakes of gold.
Art nouveau glace, he said,
observing the direction of her gaze. Did he notice everything?
In the style of Klimt. You have heard of Klimt. I had the good fortune to see some of his paintings in Vienna, before the war. Extraordinary work. There was one called Danae, the woman of myth visited by Zeus in a shower of gold. Klimt shows she is aroused by the gold as it pours between her legs.
Eve had no desire to discuss any kind of arousal in this room, artistic or otherwise.
No, I have not heard of it.
It is abandon.
He unbuttoned his cuffs, dropping the cufflinks into her hand to examine. He proceeded to turn back his sleeves, displaying lean forearms, pale-skinned and smooth. And Eve avoided the sight by holding the little molded glass objects to the light and watching the play of colors.
Gilt-edged abandon. People thought it obscene, but what of it? They thought Baudelaire obscene too.
Eve placed the cufflinks carefully beside the bust of the poet, studying the brutal marble profile, and wondering if Baudelaire's mistress had despised him as Eve despised René.
May I ask a favor, monsieur?
A favor? You intrigue me.
May I miss one night's work in 2 days' time? I promised a friend I would accompany her to visit her uncle, and he lives at some distance.
All perfectly true. With René, Eve did her best to confine her lies to what was unspoken.
You wish to miss work?
He measured the words.
There are many who would replace you, you know, and promise not to miss any work.
I know, monsieur.
Eve gave him the pleading, doe-eyed look.
I hoped you were pleased with my service, enough to...
He let her hang there for a while as he set the ledger aside.
Very well,
he said at last, and Eve nearly sagged with relief.
You may have your day.
Thank you, he cut her off.
It is quite late. Have you remembered your curfew exemption, or shall I have to walk you home again?
He unknotted his tie.
Perhaps I shall walk you home anyway. I would like to further our acquaintance, Marguerite.
He took possession of her name, or what he thought was her name, casually discarding Mademoiselle. And Eve didn't think, as he removed his tie altogether, that he intended to walk out anywhere this evening. Any furthering of acquaintance would be happening right here.
Because I asked for a favor.
She wanted to swallow the lump in her throat, and she let herself, so he could see her throat move. Nervousness would please him. He dropped his tie along the leather arm of his chair.
Have you considered my offer of the other evening?
Eve didn't pretend to misunderstand.
Your offer surprised me, monsieur.
Did it?
I am not the right companion for a man of taste. I am a waitress. I have no beauty, no proper manners, no knowledge of the world. So yes, your offer surprised me greatly.
He rose from his deep chair, unhurried, going to the little satinwood table laden with crystal decanters. He unstoppered one and poured two fingers of something pale and sparkling into a tumbler. It glittered like a diamond, and he handed it to Eve.
Try it.
She sipped, not seeing a choice. It burned her throat. Fiery sweet, faintly floral, very powerful.
Elderflower liqueur.
He rested an elbow against the ebony mantelpiece.
I get it privately from a winter in Grasse. Beautiful country, Grasse. The air smells like that liqueur, flower-scented and eddy. It's unique, so I don't serve it at my restaurant. Brandy, schnapps, champagne, those I give to the Germans. I save the unique for myself. I think you like it.
I do.
No point in lying to Renée about anything she didn't have to. Why share it with me if you do not share the unique?
Because you too are unique. You are in possession of good taste, Marguerite. Very good taste, I would guess. But utterly untutored. Like Eve in our Garden of Eden.
How Eve managed not to jump at the sound of her real name, she did not know. But she managed, sipping more elderflower fire.
I have always appreciated good taste and elegance in my companions, he continued. Before now I have preferred a finished product to a block of raw material. But Lille does not offer much in the way of elegant women these days. Hunger and patriotism have made shrews of all the ones I know. If I wish a suitable companion, it has struck me that I will have to play Pygmalion from the Greek myth, and sculpt one for myself.
He reached up with one long finger and pushed a thread of hair off her forehead.
I had not really thought I would enjoy the process. So you see, you too have managed to surprise me.
Eve couldn't think of any reply. He didn't seem to anticipate an answer, just gestured at her glass.
More?
Yes. He poured another generous measure. He is trying to make me drunk, Eve thought. 17-year-old Marguerite would not have much of a head for a strong drink. A few glasses of this would make her pliant and willing. Eve looked into her glass and saw the train tracks that would carry the Kaiser toward Lille. She saw the lazy figures of the Commandant and his officers, grouped around their schnapps, idly spilling secrets. She saw Lily's beaming face the day Eve successfully passed on her first bit of information. She even heard Lily's voice. What a bitch this business is. Maybe, Eve thought now, as she replied then. But someone has to do it. I'm good at it. Why not me? She drained her glass. When she lowered the tumbler, René was standing much closer. He smelled of Paris cologne, something subtle and civilized. She wondered if now was the moment he would kiss her. She thought fleetingly of Captain Cameron, looking at her on the beach as he taught her to load a pistol. She banished the thought as René bent his head. Don't recoil. He leaned close, inhaling along the line of her throat. And then he straightened with a faint moo.
Perhaps a bath. You may avail yourself of my facilities.
Her lips tingled, untouched. And for a moment she didn't understand. Then she looked down at her hands, her cuffs which showed tiny splashes of beurre blanc and red wine, no matter how careful she was throughout her shift, and realized she had a faint film of dried sweat beneath her dress from this morning's brisk walk in the countryside with Lily. I smell, Eve thought, and it was so humiliating she wanted to weep. I smell like sweat and cheap soap, and before I can be deflowered I must be properly cleansed.
There is soap.
René turned away, loosening his collar in a matter-of-fact yank.
I chose it for you.
He was waiting for gratitude. Thank you, Eve managed to say, as he indicated the door behind him. The bathroom had the same obscene luxury as his study, black and white tiles, a vast marble tub, a gilt-framed mirror. There was a cake of unused soap laid out, Lily of the Valley, undoubtedly requisitioned from some woman's bathroom on a raid. And Eve remembered Renée saying that scent would suit her. Light, sweet, fragrant, young. Every bit of advice Lily had given her about the acts which pleased men poured through Eve's mind, and for a moment she thought she was going to be sick, but she shoved it down. "Notice what pleases him," Lily had said. Staring at the soap, Eve knew. Light, sweet, fragrant, young. How he wanted her to be, not just smell. Thoughtful of him to have provided a script. She filled the tub, splashing hot water with vengeful wastefulness, and sank into the heat with a shiver. For more than 2 months, she'd had to take her baths from a wash basin with a frayed hand towel. The heat and the 2 glasses of elderflower liqueur were making her head swim. She could lurk in the warm, scented water forever, but she had a job to do. Better to get it over with. Eve left her underclothes and worn dress on the floor, rather than pull them back over her clean body, wrapping herself instead in snowy towels. She looked at herself in the mirror and didn't recognize the girl she saw. Her cheekbones pressed out, a memento of the lean rations on which she now lived. But it was more than that. Soft-faced Evelyn Gardner surely never looked so flint-hard. Marguerite Lefrancois wasn't hard at all. So Eve practiced in the mirror. Parted lips, trembling lashes, until it was perfect.
Ah.
Renée greeted her with a smile, inspecting her from bare feet to loosened nut-brown hair.
Much better.
Thank you, she said. I haven't had such a bath in months. Gratitude. She knew it was required. He twined his hand in her damp hair, bringing a handful to his nose.
Lovely.
He wasn't unhandsome, lean and elegant. His suit changed for a dressing gown of figured smoke-blue silk. His cool hand slipped up the length of Eve's hair and wrapped around her throat. The fingers so long he could almost circle it. He kissed her then, leisurely, open-mouthed, skillful. His eyes stayed open the whole time.
"You will stay the night," he murmured,
stroking the line of her hip through the towel.
"I meet with Commandant Hoffman tomorrow morning, rather early. He wishes to discuss a celebration at the restaurant for that flying ace of theirs, Max Immelmann, now that he is to be charged with Lille's sole air defense. But I don't mind going to the Commandant a trifle ill-rested."
There it was, the reason Eve was here. Renée let his guard down enough to give her that snippet of information, which would surely be of interest to the RFC. Eve filed it away, her heartbeat slowing to a calm crawl of terror and resolve. Renée smiled down at her.
"So,"
he said, taking hold of the towel wrapped around her breasts.
"Show me."
"Get through it," Eve thought fiercely. "Because you can use this. Oh, yes, you can." She let the towels drop, tilting her face up for his next kiss. What did it matter if something scared you, when it simply had to be done? Part 3. Chapter 17. Charlie. May, 1947. We were halfway to Paris, and I was surprised we hadn't ended up in a ditch. It was May, and the French countryside bloomed around us, but neither Finn nor I paid any attention, because Eve sat in the back seat telling us all about being a spy. A spy? Eve. A spy? I was turned all the way around in my seat, gaping at her as she talked, and even Finn kept craning over his shoulder to look. "You'll crash the bloody car," she told him tartly. "And you, Yank, will end up with a fly in your mouth." "Keep going," I urged. All I knew about spies was from movies, and I never thought any of it was true. But here was Eve, And maybe she didn't fit Hollywood's idea of a spy, but there was something about her raspy, matter-of-fact voice as she talked to Folkestone and Cyfering and Uncle Edward that made me believe every word. The Lagonda ate up the miles of winding French roads, and she kept talking. A restaurant called Le Laitier, its elegant owner.
Line after line after line of Baudelaire.
A fellow spy with round spectacles and a codename of Violette. The woman in the china shop, I exclaimed, and got a withering glare.
No putting one over on you, is there?
I grinned, immune to her sarcasm. I was still giddy and unbelieving that I had walked away from my mother at that hotel. My mother and the appointment, and my whole planned-out life. But I'd had an absolutely enormous breakfast, and on a full stomach, nervousness had changed into a sense of adventure. I was in a car with an ex-convict and an ex-spy, barreling down on an unknown future. If that wasn't a set of mathematical variables that equaled adventure, I didn't know what was. Eve talked on and off. Wartime Lille, the shortages and requisitions. René Bordelon, that name came and went. Her employer. But from the hatred in her voice, I knew he'd been more than that.
René,
Finn said, arm resting along the back of the seat as he looked over his shoulder at Eve.
Do you think he's still alive?
She wouldn't answer that, just grunted and started taking nips from her flask. Finn asked something about who she worked for, if there was anyone else in her network besides Violette. And she sat silent for a while and then said,
One or two.
I wanted to ask more. I was burning to ask more. But I met Finn's eyes and we both quieted. This was a tentative new triumvirate being built among the three of us. Eve wasn't here because I was paying her. She was here out of choice, and I no longer had the right to pry. Besides, I had even more respect for her now that I knew something of her true history, so I put a lid on my pot full of questions. She took another sip from her flask, manipulated so clumsily in those lobster claw hands, and my sense of adventure sobered. Whatever made her hands look like that, it had happened in the course of her war work, as much a battle wound as the limp my brother had brought home from Tarawa. He'd been awarded a Purple Heart in a box that had been sitting next to him when he blew his head off. What kind of inner hurts did Eve carry? She was getting hazy in the afternoon sun, talking on and off. Mid-sentence, she began to snore.
Let her doze, said Finn. I need to stop for petrol anyway.
How far are we from Paris? We'd all agreed on a night stay in Paris on the way to Limoges.
A few hours.
We've already been driving for hours. It's not that far. Finn grinned.
I took a wrong turn listening to her describe how to decode ciphers, and we went halfway to Reims.
In a pearly pink twilight, we stopped at a drab hotel on the outskirts of the city. No boulevard grandeur on this shrinking wallet. But shrinking wallet or no, there was something I had to buy, once Eve and Finn were checking into the hotel that smelled of day-old bouillabaisse. After a short walk down the line of shops, I found a pawn shop. It took only a few minutes to find what I needed, and I was on my way back to the hotel when I passed another shop. Second-hand clothes. And I was tired of alternating the same three sets of clothing and sleeping in my slip. A saleswoman looked up from the counter, one of those tiny, purse-lipped French women with perfectly tailored hems, like a chic little monkey.
Mademoiselle.
It's Madame. I set down my pocketbook so she could see the wedding band on my left hand. I need a few clothes. I gave her my budget as she evaluated my size in one sweep of her eyelids, and I tried not to twist the gold ring I'd bought from the pawn shop. It was a little too big, and so was the title Madame. But we were 2 years from the end of a war, and young widows were a common sight. I might have decided to keep the little problem, but I had no intention of being spit on as an unwed mother. I knew how this worked. You got a wedding ring, you made up a story about a boy who died in the war, in my case after it, and embellished it with a few convincing details. Maybe people looked skeptical, but they didn't say anything because you had the right props, a second-hand wedding ring, and a dead husband. Donald, I decided as I stepped into a cubicle to change. Donald McGowan was my non-existent dead husband, half Scottish and half American, dark-haired. Tank Corps, served with Patton. The great love of my life, Donald was, dead in a recent car accident. He always drove too fast. I'd warned him and warned him. I'd name my child after him if he was a boy. I imagined Rose wrinkling her nose at me.
You don't want a son named Donald, Charlie. Really?
You're right, I told her. But I think it's a girl anyway, so Donald will work just fine.
He sounds boring.
Don't you insult my Donald.
Madame,
came the saleswoman, sounding dubious, and I tamped down my laughter, trying on one set of second-hand clothes after another. Under all these airy imaginings, I was laying plans, however vague, thinking that if I found Rose, there might be a place for the two of us together. Perhaps here in France. Who knew? I had money, savings. Why couldn't we buy ourselves a new beginning, where two false madames with two false wedding rings could make some kind of honest life? I thought of the Provençal Café where I'd spent the happiest day of my childhood at Rose's side. Was there a haven like that for us now that we were grown? A café, I thought, remembering how much I'd enjoyed not just that Provençal afternoon, but my brief coffee shop job at Bennington. The waiting on customers, the rush of delicious smells, the easy pleasure of juggling orders and making change in my head. A café, somewhere here in France. I imagined a place with postcards for sale, and sandwiches of soft goat cheese and marbled ham, where Edith Piaf played in the evenings, and the tables were pushed back for dancing. Where two young widows kept the cash till and flirted with Frenchmen, though never without mournful glances at the photographs of our husbands. I'd have to get some good fake photographs.
Bien,
the saleswoman said as I came out, nodding approval at the narrow black trousers and the cropped striped jersey cut high at the collarbone, but nearly showing my midriff.
The new look is not for you,
she instructed me brusquely, sorting through the stack of clothes that had fit me and culling it down to the narrowest skirts, the tightest sweaters, the slimmest trousers.
You dress like Dior, but you are made for Chanel. I knew her. She's little and dark and plain, too.
Well, thank you. I looked around the dim shop, nettled. And I doubt you know Chanel.
I worked at her atelier before the war. If she comes back to Paris, I will work for her again. But until then I get by. We all get by. But not in horrible clothes.
The saleswoman glared, leveling a varnished fingernail at me.
No more ruffles. When you shop, you must think tailored, stripes, flats. Quit torturing that air into waves. Chop it off at the chin.
I looked at myself in the mirror. The trousers and jersey might be second-hand, but I looked rather smart. A bit boyish. And comfortable. No waist cinchers or crinolines. The saleswoman perched a little straw hat over my eye at a rakish angle, and I grinned. I'd never chosen my own clothes before. Maman always dictated what I wore. But I was a madame now. A grown woman, not a helpless girl. And it was time I looked like it.
How much?
We haggled. I had limited francs to spare. But I'd seen how covetously the saleswoman eyed my traveling suit, even as she turned up her nose at the new look.
Modeled right off the Dior collection, and I've got another at my hotel. I'll drop it by tomorrow if you give me the trousers, the two skirts, the jerseys, and that black dress. You may only have the black dress if you promise to wear it with pearls and very red lipstick.
I haven't got the pearls right now, but I can do the lipstick.
Done.
I headed back to the hotel with my parcel of clothes and a swing in my hips. I had the pleasure of seeing Finn's eyebrows go up as I joined him and Eve, where they were having drinks at the hotel café.
Happy to meet you,
I said, and presented my hand with its new wedding ring.
I'm Mrs. Donald McGowan.
Bloody hell, Eve said, and took a gulp of martini that looked like straight gin.
I patted the little problem.
A cover identity seemed practical.
Donald McGowan, Finn asked. And who is he?
Dark-haired, lantern-jawed, Yale Law School, served in the Tank Corps. I daubed my eyes with an imaginary black-bordered handkerchief. The love of my life.
Not bad to start,
Eve critiqued.
Did he like his socks folded or rolled?
Folded.
No, black coffee or cream? Did he have brothers and sisters? Did he play football at university? Details, Yank.
Eve pointed a stern finger.
It's the little details that sell a cover story. Make up a biography for your Donald and study it till you can reel it off with no flubs. And wear that ring all the time, till you get that little groove in your finger that long-married women have. People look for that groove when they see young girls wheeling baby prams and calling themselves missus.
I grinned.
Yes, ma'am.
Shall we go get supper?
Yes, and I'll cover this one. You've been buying till now.
A small acknowledgement that she wasn't here anymore for my money. That touched me, though I knew better than to say so.
As long as you let me check the bill, I answered instead. You'd sign your name to any set of numbers they wrote down.
Whatever you say.
She took the bill the waiter had just put down for drinks and pushed it over to me.
You're the banker.
I am, aren't I? Somehow, over the course of this week, money matters had matter-of-factly become my domain, even if I was the youngest one here. Finn and Eve automatically looked to me to haggle with hotel clerks over room rates. Receipts were passed promptly to my hands for proper calculation. Spare coins and cash came to me to be organized, since my traveling companions would otherwise let everything float loose in a mess of pocket change and pencil stubs. Honestly, you two, I scolded as I scribbled on the bill for the drinks. Eve up to her neck in espionage skills, and you able to keep that car running on spit and baling wire, Finn. And neither of you can calculate a tip without 10 minutes figuring and a scratch pad.
Easier if we just let you do it, Finn said. Wee little adding machine you are.
I grinned again, remembering the London banker who thought me too young and stupid to manage my own money. Here I was managing money for three. It made me wonder what else I could manage.
I turned my false wedding ring around my finger, imagining myself sitting behind a well-organized till, dish towel tucked into my narrow trousers, hair chopped smartly at the chin.
I imagined Rose with her blonde curls and chic black dress, presiding with me as French jazz played and two babies crowed. Not just little problems, but growing problems with fat little feet, gabbling in both French and English. I imagined Mrs. Donald McGowan and Madame Etienne Fournier, both of them doing fine. Just fine. Chapter 18. Eve. July 1915. Eve had never seen Lily so exasperated.
Focus, little Daisy. Your mind is 1,000 miles away.
I'll focus, Eve promised. But all she could think was, I'm sore. Not very sore. René Bordelon had taken some care not to hurt her. Not overwhelming care, just as much as didn't interfere with his own enjoyment. But care, yes. There had been a little blood, but not a great deal of pain. That will be all, Eve thought when she was permitted to dress and go home. One more night working, then the morning train with Lily to Brussels and Captain Cameron. The report on the Kaiser's visit to Lille. She would not have to think about René until after that. But he kept her the next night, too, after her shift was done, which had shocked her.
I know I should give you more time to heal, he said with his faint smile. But you are very tempting. Do you mind?
No, Eve said, because what else could she say? So there was a second time, and she rose from bed afterward and dressed as René watched her.
I look forward to your return, he'd said.
Sitting up in bed, extraordinarily long fingers pleating the sheet about one knee.
As do I,
Eve replied, keeping an eye upon the clock, ticking toward 4 in the morning. She was scheduled to meet Lily at Lille station in less than 4 hours.
But I'm afraid I must go. Thank you.
Never forget the gratitude.
For the day off from work, monsieur.
He didn't ask her to call him René, even though he'd taken full possession of her name. He just smiled as she shrugged into her coat.
How little you ever really say, Marguerite. Most women are such cackling hens. Silent one, I love you all the more because you run from me.
Eve didn't have to ask the poet. Baudelaire, she thought. It's always bloody Baudelaire. and not 4 hours later she'd gone to meet Lily, not composed and cautious and focused on the task ahead, but short of sleep and smelling like René Bordelon. And sore. Eve was careful not to let that show in her walk as they hurried to the train station. Lily would have to know at some point, but not now when she was focused on getting them through a border crossing. And Captain Cameron would not know at all. Eve Gardner was not trading her virginity for a trip back to England away from the fight. She was going back to René's bed, because even after just 2 nights, she already knew that he liked to talk over a pillow. There was the bit he'd let slip about the German flyer Max von Immelmann. There were a few more details on the Kaiser's upcoming visit. Oh yes, René talked in bed, and Eve intended to listen. As for the rest, well, she would get used to it. That was all.
"Not good," Lily muttered,
and Eve realized she'd gone into a daze again. "Focus," she snapped to herself, and saw what worried Lily. The station platform swarmed with German officers, German soldiers, German officials. Eve's gloved palms began to sweat. "Has someone been taken?" she murmured inaudibly. The great fear in the Alice network was that one of Lily's sources would be arrested, made to tell what they knew. They were all careful to know as little as possible, but...
"No,"
Lily murmured back, craning discreetly through the shuffle of uniforms.
"It's some stuffed shirt of a general getting a grand welcome. Of all the days."
They pressed their way toward the sentry, checking tickets and identity cards. But the crush was fierce, and the train already there, chuffing like a horse impatient to be off. And the sentries were meticulous with so many high brass on the platform.
"Let me do the talking," Lily said.
She was Vivienne, the cheese seller today, with a straw boater and a high-throated blouse of worn lace. And the story was prepared. She would address the guards while Eve had an armload of packages ready to juggle and drop, so they were more inclined to be impatiently waved through. But eyes were lingering fiercely on anyone not in a German uniform, and the lines inched along.
"We cannot miss that train," Eve thought,
gnawing her lip until Lily got to the front of the line. She was just reaching for her identity cards when a German-accented voice called out in French.
"Mademoiselle de Bettigny, can that be you?"
Eve saw the German first, over Lily's shoulder, moustached, perhaps 45, his hair combed to a point on his forehead. He glittered gold and rank, heavy epaulettes, a double row of medals, and Eve recognized him. Ruprecht, Crown Prince of Bavaria, General Oberst of the 6th Army, and one of the best generals the Fritzes had. He had visited Lille 3 weeks ago, Eve remembered, with frozen clarity, and dined at Le Laitier, where he complimented both René Bordelon's Tarte Alsacienne and the German airfield's new Fokker Eindecker aircraft. Eve, pouring his brandy, had stored away his comments about the Fokker. And now here he was, bearing down on them both in a crowd of German aides, his hand falling on Lily's shoulder as he exclaimed,
"Louise de Bettigny, it is you!"
For an instant Lily still faced away from him, her hand half out of her handbag with the identity cards of Vivienne the cheese seller, and Eve saw her eyes go blank. Only for a split second, and then Lily swept Vivienne's cards back into the bag like a gambler flicking away a losing hand. Her shoulders straightened as she turned, her smile dialed from Vivienne's eager-to-please smirk, up to something far more brilliant. And she dropped a curtsy Eve was fast to imitate.
"Your Royal Highness! You know very well how to flatter a lady, knowing her only from the back of her neck under an exceedingly unattractive hat."
The general kissed Lily's hand, his stars and medals flashing.
"You need no stack of silk roses to dazzle, mademoiselle."
Lily, Louise, dimpled at him, and even in the midst of dizzying shock, Eve marveled at how completely the leader of the Alice network had altered herself. Her smile was now a flash of confidence. Her chin had a proud angle, and with the tip of a finger, her dismal boater sank over one eye at a dashing angle, just like any of those cartwheel-sized mounds of gauze she'd left in train compartments all over France. Her voice was liquid pure French aristocrat, down on her luck aristocrat perhaps, but the court drawl was unmistakable as she said,
"Such is always my luck. I meet the Crown Prince of Bavaria in last year's lace."
a flick for her old blouse. Princess Elvira would never let me forget it.
My cousin was always very fond of you. Remember that game of chess we played in her drawing room in Holeshau, the night of...
Yes, and you won. Encircled my knights from behind and pried my king out of his castle. I should not be surprised you command the Sixth Army now, Your Royal Highness. More chatter. No one had glanced at Eve, not the general, nor his aides, nor Lily. Eve clutched her armor with packages and shifted behind Lily like a maid. In a drab hat of her own, with none of Lily's sparkle, she undoubtedly resembled a servant. The train, she saw with a shiver of fear, was leaving.
"What are you doing in Lille, Mademoiselle de Bettigny?"
the general asked, oblivious to the train or his hovering aides. Laugh lines grew at the corners of his eyes, and his smile was avuncular. If he weren't one of the best leaders at the Kaiser's disposal, Eve would probably have liked him.
"Such a dreary place."
"You made it dreary," Eve thought, and any possibility of liking disappeared. "On my way into Belgium to see my brother. If I can even get across the border now, mon Dieu, my train has gone." Lily made a comic face of despair, a tragic Columbine clown, and the general immediately snapped for one of his hovering aides.
"A car for Mademoiselle de Bettigny and her maid. You will be escorted across by mine own driver." "If Mademoiselle has her identity cards," the aide said,
and Eve froze. The only cards Lily had were for an imaginary cheese seller named Vivienne. And if she was caught with them while claiming to be someone else... But Lily stood laughing, perfectly at ease as she rummaged through her handbag. "I have them here somewhere." Upending a handkerchief, a few keys, a scatter of hairpins. "Marguerite, do you have my papers?" Eve knew what to do then. Begin laboriously opening every package in her arms, shaking her head like a slow-witted country girl. All as the general looked on amused, and his aides shifted from foot to foot.
"Your Royal Highness," one murmured. "The Commandant awaits." "No need for papers. I know Mademoiselle de Bettigny perfectly well."
The general looked sad as he kissed her hand.
"From more peaceful days."
"Happier days," Lily agreed. And when the car pulled up before the station, the general handed her in himself. Eve, scarcely knowing what to think, scrambled in behind her, still juggling packages. The car's seats were richly cushioned, the smell of expensive leather overlaid motor oil. Lily fluttered her handkerchief out the window at the general, and then the door shut, and they were gliding away, in much greater luxury than a cramped train car. Lily didn't speak. Her eyes touched on the driver, and then she made a fussy comment or two about the heat, like any aristocratic lady traveling in summer. The questions rising in Eve's throat were choking her, but she looked at her lap as a lady's maid should. The car remained silent as they crossed into Belgium, in the car of a general, and a crown prince no less. They were waved straight through the checkpoints. Though the driver offered to take them to their destination, Lily refused with a charming smile, and asked to be dropped at the nearest train station. A much smaller place than the station in Lille, just a platform with a few benches.
"Merde," she said as they watched the gleaming car disappear back up the road. "I wouldn't mind a ride all the way to Brussels. Mon Dieu, I'm sick of trains. But leading a German general's aide to Uncle Edward's doorstep would probably be frowned upon. No?"
Eve was silent. She didn't even know where to begin. The platform was hot and dusty. They were alone except for an old woman dozing on the other side, well out of earshot. Lily dropped onto the nearest bench, setting her valise beside her.
"So, little Daisy," she said matter-of-factly,
"are you going to accuse me of being a German spy, just because the general of the Sixth Army happens to know me by sight?"
"No." That had flashed briefly across Eve's mind at the general's first smile. She felt ashamed to admit. But now she shook her head. If she knew nothing else, she knew that Lily was no double agent.
"Well, now you know my real name," Lily smiled, tugging off her gloves. "Very few in the network do. Just Violette and Uncle Edward."
Violette, loyal lieutenant that she was, would kill Eve slowly if she ever endangered their leader by revealing her identity. Eve accepted the secret, turning it over. Louise de Bétigné. Who is she, then?
The daughter of minor French nobility, who really should have been an actress, given how much she adores putting on new identities.
Lily took out a handkerchief, blotting her forehead in the morning heat.
But the daughters of minor French nobility do not become actresses, my dear.
What do they do, then?
When they come from families as poor as church mice? Become governesses for the children of lecherous Italian lords and Polish counts and Austrian princesses?
Louise shuddered.
Bullets, let me tell you, are quite preferable to pounding French verbs into a lot of snobbish little heirs to crumbling castles and defunct coats of arms.
Eve felt her way, cautious but ravenously curious. And how did Louise de Bétigné come to know the Crown Prince of Bavaria? Teaching his children?
Those of his cousin, Princess Elvira. Bitch. Face like a potato, temper like a prison wardress. Her lock-jawed children were dumb as paint, and thought they owned the earth. My training turned out to be useful. Governesses get plenty of practice lurking and eavesdropping. But still. A sigh. It was so dull. I tell myself that at least I wasn't hauling coal in a mine shaft, or working 18 hours in a laundry getting my fingers crushed by mangles. But I was so tired of it all. It was coming down to a choice. Give myself under a train like Anna Karenina, or become a nun. I did think rather seriously about a nunnery, but really, I'm far too frivolous.
The drone of summer insects rose all around them, the heat baked down, and the old woman across the track snored on her bench.
Anyway, Lily concluded, that's Louise de Bétigné. But she isn't really me anymore. I've become Lily instead, and I like her far better. I can understand why.
Louise de Bétigné sounded rather grand, and a little silly. A woman with a lace bertha and no skills besides pretty handwriting. It didn't match frail little Lily at all, with her darting gaze and her false-bottom bag lined with half the secrets of the German army.
I'll never let it slip, Lily. Not to anyone.
A smile.
I trust you, little Daisy.
Eve smiled back, the trust warming her to her bones.
Merde, Lily sighed again. This goddamn train, will it ever get here?
And they never mentioned it again. The train ride was dismal but short, the excitement of their encounter with the general slowly fading, to leave Eve with her brooding thoughts of René and last night. Eve didn't bother to track the streets they traversed on the way to the meeting point. She had no desire to be able to identify this house with the faded blue door, where they were quickly ushered inside. Lily had gone into Uncle Edward's study first. Eve waited in the sitting room outside, watched by a weedy young lieutenant. Lily came out, dropped a wink.
In you go. I'm going to hunt down some brandy.
She leaned close, speaking in Eve's ear so the lieutenant wouldn't overhear.
Our dear uncle seems quite eager to see you. Perhaps more than just professionally eager.
Lily, Eve hissed, looking at the lieutenant.
If you catch our good captain with his clothes off, or his guard down, ask why he took that prison sentence for his dreary wife,
Lily whispered as a passing shot.
I'm dying to know.
Eve entered her questioning session with burning ears.
Miss Gardner.
Captain Cameron rose, and Eve stopped short. She didn't know if it was the sound of her own name, which she hadn't heard for what seemed like forever, or if it was the sight of him.
I forgot what you looked like.
She thought she remembered him very well. The thin English face, the sandy hair, the tapered hands. But she'd forgotten the little things, like the way he crossed his trousered legs loosely at the knee as he reseated himself. The way he interlaced those lean hands and smiled clear to the corners of his eyes.
Do sit down,
he prompted. And Eve realized she was still standing in the doorway. She sat in the straight-backed chair across the table from him, taking time to settle her skirts.
It is good to see you, Miss Gardner.
He smiled again, and Eve had a flash to their first conversation in the boarding house parlor. Could it really be only 2 months ago? What a great deal could happen in 2 months. Like a pair of cool French hands exploring the sides of her ribs last night. The soft hollows of her elbows and wrists. The insides of her thighs. No, she was not going to think about that. Not here. Cameron looked at her over his tented fingertips, and a line appeared between his brows.
Are you well? You look...
thinner. We don't eat much in Lille.
More than that.
That trace of a Scottish lilt in his voice. She'd forgotten that as well.
How are you coping, Miss Gardner?
Spider-like fingers unhurriedly tracing her earlobes. Very well.
Are you certain?
Narrow lips tracing the cup of her navel, the spaces between her fingers. I do... I do what is necessary.
It is part of my job to evaluate our people, not just take their information.
That line between Captain Cameron's eyes hadn't gone away.
Your work has been superb. Alice Dubois... What?
Nothing, Captain. I call her Lily. The day we met, she said Alice Dubois sounded like a skinny schoolmistress with a face like a bin. He laughed.
Yes, she would. She was unstinting in her praise for you just now. You've done top-class work, but...
His eyes penetrated.
The toll of that can be high.
Not for me. Kisses with open eyes, still staring. She met Cameron's gaze, making sure her hands didn't clench in her lap. I was made for this. Captain Cameron still stared, taking in every detail of Eve's face. He wasn't in uniform, just an old suit with the jacket thrown over the chair, and shirt sleeves rolled to show lean wrists. But as much as he looked like a university professor, it would be dangerous to forget that he was an interrogator. He could slip information out of you before you even knew it was passing your lips. So Eve gave a cheerful smile, the good sport girl who keeps her stiff upper lip through everything. I thought we were here to talk about the A fist against her knee to release the word. The Kaiser's visit, Captain.
Yours were the first set of ears to hear it. Tell me, from the beginning.
Eve relayed the details again, crisp and concise. He listened, taking notes. He blinked now and then. So nice to see a man who could blink. He sat back, surveying his notes.
Anything else?
The Kaiser's arrival time has just changed. He'll be an hour later than planned.
That's new. Where did you hear it?
Waiting tables. From René, after he finished, but before he pulled out at me. He likes to stay there a while, until his sweat cools. So he'll just begin... chatting. Captain Cameron caught something in her eyes.
What is it, Miss Gardner?
How Eve liked hearing her own name again, especially from his lips. She liked it so much she knew it wasn't a good idea. You'd better keep calling me Marguerite Lefrançois, she said. Safer.
Very well.
The questions about the Kaiser's visit continued. Captain Cameron examined it from all angles, isolating every detail Eve could offer. He extracted one or two things she hadn't thought of and seemed pleased.
That should do it,
he said, rising.
You have been a very great help.
Thank you, Eve rose. Tell the RFC not to miss. Tell them to bomb that train to shards. Her intensity kindled an answering fire in his gaze.
Agreed.
As she turned for the door, she heard his voice again with its faint Scottish lilt.
Be careful.
I am careful. She set her hand to the doorknob.
Are you? Lily worries. She worries for all her contacts, since she's a bit of a mother hen. But she says you're walking a very tight wire.
Renée's lean weight coming down in the dark. As you say, she's a mother hen. His voice came closer.
Eve.
Don't call me that. She whirled around, advancing until they stood nose to nose. It's not my name anymore. I'm Marguerite Lefrançois. You made me into Marguerite Lefrançois. I'm not going to be Eve again until this war is over, or until I'm dead. Do you hear me?
There's no need for anyone to die. Be careful.
Stop. She wanted to lean forward and nail her mouth against his. It would stop him talking, and she knew his lips would be warm. You can't. You'll like it too much. Like hearing her name in his soft voice.
It was bad for Marguerite,
and it was bad for her work. She began to pull away, but Captain Cameron's hand found her waist.
It's very hard, he said softly. What we do, it's all right to find it hard. If you want to talk to me, I don't want to talk, she rasped. It might do you good, Eve.
She couldn't hear him say her name again. She could not. Of course, that was why he was using it. She'd shown a weak point and he was pushing it. The handler, seeing if his charge was close to cracking. Part of his job, evaluating her. Eve put her chin up, blindly turning the conversation to rock him back on his heels instead. Either let me out of this room, Cameron, or take me someplace where we won't do any talking. She had no idea where those words came from. Idiot. Idiot. Cameron stared at her, plainly surprised. But his hand still warmed the side of her waist. Eve knew she should step away, but a hungry part of her wanted to step closer and damn the consequences. She wanted to lie down with this man, whose every word and reaction she wouldn't need to sift, measure, and weigh. But Cameron stepped away, mutely adjusting the gold band on his left hand. "Your wife sent you to prison," Eve said bluntly. "From what I heard..." The unspoken words were, "What do you owe a wife like that?" He reared back.
"Who told you?"
"Major Allenton, back in Folkestone. Why did you confess guilt when your wife was the one who committed fraud?" Eve had Cameron on the defensive for once, and she kept pushing.
"I suppose it's no secret."
He turned away, putting his hands on the back of a chair.
"I thought I could save her from prison. My wife, she's always been unhappy. She wanted a child desperately, and she couldn't have one. She kept thinking every few weeks that this was the time. Then the disappointment every month made her do strange things. Steal things, then make a fuss when they were missing. Fire the maids for listening at the door when they were on the other side of the house. Become obsessed with money, providing for a child's future when we didn't even have one yet. And claim her pearls had been stolen so she could cash in the insurance."
He rubbed at his forehead.
"When that came out, she begged me to take the sentence for her. Someone had to go to prison, and she said she was too afraid. I wanted to spare her. She's so fragile."
"She's a liar who was content to let you take the punishment for her crime," Eve thought. "Even if it destroyed your career and your life." But it sounded harsh and unforgiving, and she didn't say it.
"She is to have a child in the spring."
He turned around.
"She's much calmer now that it's finally happened. She's happier."
"You aren't." He shook his head, his half-hearted denial, but Eve could read him like a book. He was weary and heartsick, they both were. And they might all be dead soon in this hellish place of war and blood. She stepped closer, knowing this was a very bad idea, but unable to stop, wanting so badly to banish the thoughts of René's spider-like hands and toneless voice. "I'm here," she thought. "Take me." Cameron lifted her hand, bringing it to his lips. The sad gesture of a knight errant, one who could never take advantage of a lady. It was on the tip of Eve's tongue to tell him she was no innocent anymore, that he wouldn't be taking anything René Bordelon hadn't got first. But she couldn't tell him that. He might remove her from Lille. He might do that anyway if she lay with him as she wanted to. "Fool," Marguerite's voice hissed in Eve's head. "Stupid girl, what did Lily tell you? They all think a Rosenthal isn't to be trusted, and you go throwing yourself at him like a whore." "He won't think that of me," Eve thought. "He's not so narrow as that." But Marguerite was warier. Risk nothing. Eve stepped back. Nothing to overt had been said. Quite. She could deny she meant anything intimate, even if they both knew better. "Pardon me, Uncle Edward. Are we finished here?"
"Quite finished, mademoiselle. Take care of yourself in Lille."
"Lily takes care of me. She and Violette."
"Marguerite, Lily, and Violette."
He smiled, and the worry in his eyes bordered on agony.
My flowers.
Fleur du mal, Eve heard herself saying, and shivered.